Today is Friday, June 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. As the number of COVID-19 cases continues rising in the U.S., did states reopen too quickly?
What we need to understand is that things are not normal right now. I think people have forgotten about the virus.
Plus, economic indicators show global economy shrinking. But are things that bad?
I think, unfortunately, the reality is yes, they are.
And the United Nations turned 75. Those stories and more are next. While China moved closer to containing a fresh outbreak in Beijing, the coronavirus took a stronger hold elsewhere. That includes the United States, where surging infections across southern states have highlighted the risks of reopening economies without effective treatment or vaccines. Another record daily increase in India on Friday pushed the country's caseload towards 500,000, and other countries with large populations such as Indonesia, Pakistan, and Mexico grappled with growing caseloads and strained healthcare systems. South Africa, which accounts for about half of the infections on the African continent, reported a record 6,579 new cases. Johns Hopkins University puts the total number of confirmed global cases at over 9.6 million. Now, the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases is quickly approaching 2.5 million in the U.S. And earlier today, I spoke with internal medicine physician Runjun Misra in San Francisco about the increases in the cases and what that means for plans to reopen.
What's important to remember is that as much as we're trying to boost our economies worldwide and reopen to some extent, some countries, a little bit slower than others, what we need to understand is that things are not normal right now. I think people have forgotten about the virus. I think as scared as people were a couple months ago, they're completely different in their attitude towards coronavirus at this time. And the fact of the matter is the virus is still out there. So even though the virus has not changed, our habits have. And that's why we see the numbers rising the way that they have, because I can speak for the way things are happening in America. And the fact is that people are just not being as vigilant. Masks are coming off. Sometimes people are not wearing them at all. People are not social distancing and being so aggressive about hand washing and using the hand sanitizer. We're not seeing that either. So the numbers will continue to go up if we don't continue to follow the same kind of restrictions that were placed upon us and we placed upon ourselves a few months ago.
You mentioned people aren't really thinking about the virus anymore. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control recently said that, perhaps 24 million Americans have COVID-19 or had COVID-19. That's a 10 times fold increase over than what is already confirmed. So if you're saying that people perhaps aren't taking the virus as seriously as they should, given the 2.4 million number, what happens if that 24 million number is accurate?
Well, I think it is probably accurate because there are a lot of people who are asymptomatic who actually are COVID positive. What we need to remember is that the prevalence of this virus and how contagious it is very, very different than the flu. The flu usually has a mortality rate that is much less than what we've seen of coronavirus. And usually we see somewhere around the 45,000 to 60,000, cases of death in a year with coronavirus. And you obviously, the numbers are upwards of 120,000 already in a few months for coronavirus. So we need to remember that it's much more contagious than the flu. It's much more prevalent than the flu right now. And we need to remember that we have to stay home as much as possible because this virus has not gone anywhere. Until we get a vaccine that is safe, until we get a vaccine that is effective, we still need to stay at home as much as possible.
Dr. Runjun Misra is an internal medicine physician in the San Francisco Bay Area of California. After the International Monetary Fund predicted that the global economy will shrink nearly 5% this year, the U.S. Commerce Department released data showing a 5% fall in the United States' gross domestic product. Now, to help make sense out of these numbers, I spoke to Jacob Kierkegaard, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I began our conversation by asking him, are the numbers as bad as they look?
I think, unfortunately, the reality is yes, they are. We're seeing the highest level of totally recorded new COVID cases globally. We're obviously seeing a very significant rebound also here in the United States. And the combination of that creates, and the fact, by the way, that you know, various variations of lockdown measures remain in place in most countries around the world. It is true that Europe and China and Japan and others have been opening up, but that doesn't mean that things are back to normal. We recently also, for instance, had a significant other outbreak in Beijing in China. So it's not clear that the pandemic is under control nationally or globally.
Now, before you go on, I want to ask you about that, because you brought up this whole reopening thing. I mean, things are starting to reopen in the United States and in Europe elsewhere, and you presume that businesses are going to see more action, as it were, to say, and have more revenue. But then as we see the increase in cases, people are talking about slowing things down again. So could there be like a whiplash effect?
I think absolutely we would have to assume that there is a whiplash effect, because whatever politicians or business leaders might want with regards to the positive effect of reopening economies, it is not clear that consumers are listening. If consumers, what we have seen previously is that consumers respond in a way to protect their lives, their own lives, and those of their families, and they will not spend money. They will not go back to pre-crisis patterns of behavior if they feel that the pandemic is out of control. So I therefore do not believe that we should expect the kind of economic recovery in the parts of the United States where the surge in the pandemic is now unfolding. This is true also globally, all of which means that we have an absolutely unprecedented decline in global trade that continues because of the pandemic. So, no, the world, as well as the United States, we remain in a very bad place. We need a global available medical remedy for this crisis before people are going to go back to the way they spent and lived their lives beforehand. We're all in this together, unfortunately. That means that a full recovery of the global economy, and therefore also national economies, isn't, in my opinion, something we should expect in the coming, only in the medium to long run. And by that, I mean, you know, several years from now.
Jacob Kierkegaard is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. And coming up later,
the European Union's top diplomat has voiced concern about deteriorating relations between Greece and Turkey. Rallying to the defense of Greece, an EU member state, though, Josep Borrell warned Turkey that any attempt to undermine Greece's borders and rights would be considered an equal affront to the EU.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2015, scientists at the LIGO and Virgo collaborations proved an Einstein theory when they detected gravitational waves produced by the merger of two black holes. Because they don't produce light in the visible spectrum nor electromagnetic radiation, any light that might be produced by the black hole mergers has not been seen. However, when gravitational waves were detected by LIGO and Virgo on May 21, 2019, scientists using Caltech's Zwicky Transient Facility at the Palomar Observatory near San Diego did see what might be a flare of light produced by the merging black holes. The scientists determined that the observed light flare came from the very same region in the sky and occurred near the same time as the detected gravitational wave. The scientists also admit that what they saw could be something completely different. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton defended his scathing critique of U.S. President Donald Trump as an erratic leader willing to undercut American security to improve his re-election prospects. Bolton explains why to VOA special contributor Greta Van Susteren as he promotes his new highly controversial memoir, The Room Where It Happened, about his time in the Trump administration.
Well, I don't think the president has a worldview. I don't think he has a philosophy or a grand strategy, and he doesn't follow policy. It's about his personal instincts at any given moment, always focused on his reelection. But I've never seen a president, never read about a president, never experienced a president who didn't have some kind of guiding strategy other than his own political fortunes. Every president, every political leader in a democracy takes politics into account. No secret there.
So other presidents were also interested in reelection.
Absolutely. This is the only president, to my knowledge, that has had almost no other interest than his reelection.
One of the things you write about in your book is a note that you said that Secretary of State Pompeo passed to you that was derogatory about the president. Do you have that note?
No, he had written it down on his own notepad. We were both sitting there taking notes, and he sort of slid it over to me, and I nodded my head, and he took it back.
So it would be his note. If it exists, if it still exists, he has the note.
He has the note.
And what did he say?
He said the president was full of
Was it about one specific statement the president said?
It was in response to a particular statement, but I took it to mean a response to the discussion we had had for perhaps 15-20 minutes or so at that point.
What did Secretary of State Pompeo at about that time, what was he saying about the president to you? I mean, what was his general view of the president?
Well, we had a lot of discussions about the president, and I think on many substantive issues, I'd say Iran, for example, is a good case study of that. Substantively, Mike Pompeo and I saw things much the same way. I think the difference is that he was less willing to disagree with the president and to try and guide him in a different direction. Look, the president makes the decisions. There's no doubt about that. There's nobody in the White House or the administration who didn't understand that. The question is, do you simply acquiesce in a policy that you think is misguided, or do you continue to try and press the president to appreciate the broader significance of his decisions? Look, ultimately, if you're not having success and you're not able in good faith to defend the president publicly, then you should resign, which is ultimately what I did. But I thought Mike didn't like the policies, but wouldn't challenge them.
He's come out very hard against you in your book, Secretary of State Pompeo has. And I mean, he's basically said that you're making things up.
Right. Well, I have a very clear recollection of these events. I did the best I could to put them down on paper. I think Mike sees his political future, and he has higher ambitions. I think he sees his futures tied to President Trump, and I feel sorry for him for that.
That was former National Security Advisor John Bolton speaking to VOA special contributor Greta Van Susteren. Atlanta Council Senior Fellow Mark Simakovsky spoke to VOA via Skype to give a perspective on Bolton and the claims in his new book.
I think it's self-serving. Right now for Bolton to claim that somehow that he was an obstacle to the administration. I mean, in many ways, he enabled administration policy. He was an architect for many of the policies that the administration implemented under his tenure. He's a very active national security advisor in comparison to others, and actually cut out many in the U.S. government and undermined the U.S. interagency process that the national security advisors intended to facilitate as a neutral arbiter of various inputs from the interagency. So I think it's disingenuous that he somehow saw himself as the great obstacle or the great confronter to Trump.
French President Emmanuel Macron will be attending the G5 Sahel summit taking place on Tuesday, June 30th. Reporter Catherine Field is in Paris, and I spoke with her via WhatsApp to get the details.
One of the main aspects that he'll be wanting to push at this summit will be what has happened militarily since that crucial summit here in France earlier this year. That at that summit, he said, we are going to turn a corner. We're going to change the way we are militarily on the ground. So at that summit, don't forget, he promised an extra 600 French soldiers. And since that day, they have been changing. They have changed the way that they've worked on the ground. They've got a new tactical unit, particularly in that volatile three frontier zones, that zone, Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger. So he's going to want to hear from the other G5 leaders. He's going to want to know, okay, how many more troops are you going to send in? Because at the moment, they only have troops in there from Niger. They're desperate for Chad to send more troops in there. They really do want to have a commitment that this is something that the G5 is doing, and it's not just France. So he'll want to know that. They're also, to be honest with you, the French are kind of satisfied at the moment. They've got these armed drones that are working in the area. These are new. The French defense minister says these are proving to be very effective. And of course, they're going to want to talk again about terrorism in the area. Earlier this month, there was the killing by French special forces of the head of Islamic Maghreb Al-Qaeda. Now, the French feel that that really disrupted all that particular terrorist group's activities in the region. So they're going to want to know more about that.
Speaking of the military, the United States has said it wants to draw down troops on the African continent. Is that something that is going to be part of the discussions on the military side there during this G5 Sahel summit?
The French defense minister has already said that she has had assurances from the United States that they will continue their engagement. And that's very important because all of the Sahel military operations depend on the U.S. for intelligence, logistics, supplies, and for drone intelligence. So that is vital. And the defense minister says that is going to help for the time being. She says she's got the agreement for at least another year. So a year's time is a very long time in the Sahel.
You mentioned it's a very short trip and they're looking for assurances that certain things are being taken care of. But realistically, can they get those assurances, or are there other deliverables that they really want out of this meeting?
Well, the French in particular are really keen on Chad coming up with a battalion to add to that Sahel force. They really want to see more on that. They're also, you know, hoping that they might get a few answers from the African Union as to whether the African Union is going to come up with some sort of multinational force. The Sahel is, well, the best we can say, is a complex web of issues that range from governance to terrorism that go right through to resources. So whether these will all be solved in one simple summit, I doubt it very much.
Catherine Field reports and lives in Paris, France. The European Union's top diplomat has voiced concern about deteriorating relations between Greece and Turkey. Anthony Karasava has that story.
Greece has long complained to the EU about its troubled relations with neighboring Turkey. Waging what critics call gunboat diplomacy, Turkey has threatened to use force against Greece if it moves to block it from drilling for oil and gas in the eastern Mediterranean, in waters Greece considers its own. In recent weeks also, it has threatened to send a flood of refugees to the West. The EU and its foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, are now rallying to defend Greece as never before.
You have been informing to the Foreign Affairs Council and myself about the drilling activities, the maritime claims and overflights that have led to a significant deterioration of relations between Greece and Turkey. I wanted to come here and see for myself and observe the situation of this EU external border.
The northeast border region of Evros has become a key flashpoint in escalating tensions between the two countries after Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan lifted border controls earlier this year, allowing more than 100,000 migrants and refugees to enter Europe, leaving Greece to defend EU borders. Accompanying Borrell on his border tour, Greek Foreign Affairs Minister Nikos Dendias said Greece is willing to settle differences with its longtime foe, but not under what he called its bullying terms and behavior.
We are always open to dialogue, but were not prepared to discuss under duress or help legitimize Turkey's persistent violations of legality. It is violating almost daily Greece's national airspace and territorial waters, including overflights of inhabited areas here in Evros and the Aegean Sea by armed warplanes.
Brussels' support for Greece is important as the Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis will attend a key EU summit in coming weeks to address Turkey's actions, as well as growing fears of an armed conflict following remarks by leading Turkish officials that Ankara would use force to drill in contested waters in the eastern Mediterranean. Analysts such as conservative lawmaker Tasos Hadzivasiliou are concerned that aggravated relations may deteriorate further ahead of U.S. elections. U.S. President Donald Trump, he says, has long showed a great deal of tolerance towards Turkey. That gives Erdogan, Hadzivasiliou says, a free hand to act between September and November when the U.S. presidential election will be held. Even so, the leading conservative deputy accused the EU of what he called dithering, prodding Brussels to match its criticism of Turkey with stiff sanctions. If the EU does not decide to impose sanctions on Turkey, especially financial reprisals, then all this talk and pressure will have little bearing on its behavior, he says. Turkish officials are livid about Borrell's remarks, complaining that the EU official failed to address alleged human rights violations by Greece, which has been accused of using blast bombs, rubber bullets, and live ammunition to keep refugees from entering the West earlier this year. In a statement, Turkish Foreign Ministry spokesman Hami Aksoy slammed the EU for trying to whitewash Greek human rights violations. Aksoy is not alone in his claim. Dozens of human rights groups have documented hundreds of cases of asylum seekers being robbed, abused, stripped of their clothes and personal belongings by Greek forces in recent months, sent back to Turkey, where nearly 4 million refugees remain stranded. Anthika Rasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
The United Nations marks the 75th anniversary of its founding today in a much different world than it was born into. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir looks at how the organization has matured and the challenges it faces.
Now my duty, my honor and my privilege in the chair to call for a vote on the approval of the Charter of the United Nations.
It was June 1945 in San Francisco, California, that the UN Charter was signed. Created to prevent a repeat of the atrocities of World War II, the United Nations was designed as a framework to peacefully resolve international disputes. The organization marks its 75th anniversary in a much different world, one gripped by global upheaval, says UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
From COVID-19 to climate disruption, from racial injustice to rising inequalities, we are a world in turmoil. At the same time, we have an international community with an enduring vision embodied in the Charter to guide us to a better future. Our shared challenge is to rise to this moment.
But several of the UN's major founding powers, Britain, China, Russia, and the United States, are moving further away from one of its core principles, multilateralism. This, as smaller countries are embracing it. The UN chief acknowledges that today's multilateralism needs to be more robust.
The problem is not that multilateralism is not up to the challenges the world faces. The problem is that today's multilateralism lacks scale, ambition, and teeth.
Over the years, the UN has expanded its work to include peacekeeping and humanitarian operations. Today, the organization feeds 87 million people in 83 countries, vaccinates half the world's children, and has nearly 100,000 peacekeepers deployed in 13 countries. While preventing another world war, the UN has struggled to curb conflicts in nearly every corner of the globe, making the body ineffectual, say critics. The UN is marking its anniversary during the COVID-19 pandemic, a disease that poses perhaps its single greatest challenge since its founding. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.